protection fighting style.
That requires a shield.
Dueling fighting style.
Well, I was going to say Santa Claus has to wear heavy armor. Because otherwise his AC is tanked.
Live from the Mundangerous Hot Cocoa Dispensary in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 21 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about one-shot games. But first, the Morning Glory campaign meets a very different Primus, and our jolly old elf spreads holiday cheer in the Character Creation Forge.
But before we get to that, we've got a new Unearthed Arcana this month.
Yeah, not a whole lot of information in this one.
So this one is focused on the tiefling. Namely, it gives us the abyssal tiefling, a tiefling whose heritage comes from the demons of the abyss versus the devils of the nine hells.
Right. So they split up the PHB tiefling into two subraces, the infernal tiefling, which is just the normal tiefling, and then the abyssal tiefling, which gets more demony abilities. Constitution increase instead of intelligence.
And by more demony, you mean more chaotic.
I mean more random.
Yeah. So you basically get, it scales. At first level, you get access to a random cantrip. At third level, you get access to a random first level spell. And at fifth level, you get access to a random second level spell. And there's a list of six of each.
Right, cumulative. So you get them all.
Right. Which is cool. I mean, I do like the idea that you get access to random magic. It's just a little frustrating to try and play, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if all of the spells on the list were good, but you could get True Strike as your cantrip, which is just awful.
Yeah, or Spare the Dying, which you'll probably not use in the day that you get it.
Or Light when you have Dark Vision.
Yeah, you have Dark Vision.
Now, the spells you get at third level aren't that bad. Charm Person, Cure Wounds. These are pretty useful.
No, outside of Tasha's Hideous Laughter, they're actually some of the better first level spells. So I like that.
Tasha's Hideous Laughter we put to good use with the Pacifist.
Okay, fair enough. And then at fifth level, you've got a mixed bag. You get Levitate and Spider Climb, which are kind of highly situational second level spells. But you also get Darkness, Alter Self, Invisibility, and Mirror Image. Mm-hmm. And Mirror Image is always useful. Especially at fifth level and lower levels before True Sight becomes a thing.
I was just going to say, if you're fighting six Drasks that all have True Sight, it's not that useful.
No.
There are also new spells.
Well, before that, you have this strange ability called Abyssal Fortitude, which gives you an increase to your hit point maximum equal to half your level. So one extra hit point at first and second level, up to 10 extra hit points at level 20. Ishan, try to hide your excitement.
That's pretty good. And you get plus one to con, so, you know, maybe 10, but maybe 20 hit points. No, an extra 20.
That would be 30.
Maybe 10, maybe 30.
That's all.
Probably not, though.
No. I would honestly just rather have random horns and all of the descriptive elements of the tiefling from Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide than I would that. I'd rather give up a mechanical ability.
That's what you say until you find yourself at 2 hit points.
Yeah.
And you think, oh man, these 10 hit points, they were amazing. Also, keep in mind that you do lose fire resistance.
Yeah.
So,
which
is almost always really useful.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Not a big deal. I don't think this is going to upset any campaigns. But there are new spells. They are all conjuration spells, and they all summon some form of demon. I kind of like it.
I mean, they suffer from the same drawbacks that all of these summon spells suffer from.
Right. So all conjuration spells have two main problems with them. The first is concentration generally makes them very limited value because you lose concentration, you either lose control or you lose the summoned creature.
Or it just precludes you from casting a different concentration spell.
Right.
Which are often very good.
Exactly. And you also have this problem of conjuration spells don't scale past their level. So when you get a fourth level spell, generally, that's a pretty good summon. It's a useful creature. by the time you get to 10th level and you still have a 4th level spell, that summon is useless. It's just too low level of a creature to really make an impact on combat. So its value as a 4th level spell is diminished over time.
Right. You can cast it at a higher level usually and get a better effect, but then you still aren't being able to use a 4th level spell slot to effect.
Right. And it's not like there's a single conjure spell that just gets you increasingly strong characters, right?
Right.
These are, or sorry, increasingly strong creatures. These are different spells at each slot. So you've got to memorize and prepare different spells all the time.
Which is really difficult for particularly charisma-based casters.
Yeah. So,
which you would be if you were one of these tieflings in the same document.
Right, right. But let me say, these look like a blast. Not powerful. Definitely want to see them in play, possibly by evil characters. I think they would be amazing.
I think this would be tons of fun used by the main villain in a one-shot game, because what if they start losing control of all these?
Yeah, so that's the mechanic that is special to demons, or to these conjure spells that are in this Unearthed Arcana. When you lose concentration on them, and some of them even have other triggers, but you lose control of them, and then they all have their own conditions on how they act. They don't disappear. It's amazing. One of them, the Vrock, begins to bid out his services in return for gems. He telepathically reaches out to every creature around him and sells himself to the highest bidder. I love it.
Every six rounds. Well, every 1d6 rounds.
Yeah. That's only a fifth level spell, which is probably a tolerable cost, I would say. Then you have things like the Hezru, which is a seventh level conjuration. He requests food. And if you do not offer him high enough value food, then he gets upset and starts devouring corpses. If there's no corpses, he starts making corpses to devour.
So I can see a villain who just does not care anymore summoning these creatures and then either purposefully or not caring if they lose concentration or losing the opposed charisma check and just littering the place with uncontrolled demons.
I mean, Ishin, did you see Conjure Lesser Demon? Right. You get just to summon 8 demons.
And there's just, you cover the ground. You litter the ground with tiny little demons who are hostile to everyone.
Everyone, right? Yep. All non-demons.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't think these are going to be making an appearance in your typical D&D campaign, but I think they would be a lot of fun for villains. Other than that, they're kind of hokey spells, frankly, but I had fun reading it, at least.
I'm getting a Yakety Sax vibe.
Right,
playing
right.
In my head.
Like a little Benny Hill kind of situation.
Maybe not the sheer terror you're supposed to get when confronted with demons. But
right, right, yeah.
So on to the Morning Glory recap. When last we left, the party had just awakened after a very thorough beatdown by a very confused Nistrum Shadar. And they realized that they had little more than 24 hours before what they believed was the Day of Mourning, or the date and time that they knew was the Day of Mourning. So once they collect themselves again, they decide, you know, forget this. We are going to go right to the source. And they head back to the Caneth Tower, where they had initially met Aaron DeCaneth.
And keep in mind, this is in Metrol, in Seer, in sort of the epicenter of the cataclysm that was the Day of Mourning.
Yes. So this time, you knocked on the door, and then when there was no answer, you used your Caneth key charm, essentially access passes,
right,
to get into Caneth facilities and just open the door and walked on in.
As you do.
And you met an alive Aaron DeCaneth, who was very gregarious, seemed very happy to talk to you, but totally denied any knowledge of this disjunction thing you were talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely knew absolutely nothing about, what was that thing that you mentioned again? A dis what? Disjunction? I don't know anything about it. Yeah, he was lying.
Doesn't even sound like a word.
What? But eventually, when you revealed that you knew about Primus, he said, oh, Primus, yeah, he's here.
Yes, so Primus was, well, as far as we knew, Primus was our little Caneth control cube that we had been carrying around as sort of our artifact.
Right. Up until this point, you had known that there was more about Cube that you didn't know. You knew that Cube referred to itself as Primus, and that it had at one point been more powerful than it was.
We would soon find out he was extremely powerful.
When the party entered the room, they were struck internally with a sense of power and foreboding. And then their eyes alight upon a very tall, vaguely humanoid, hairless, golden figure that was actually just from the torso up. And then below the torso was just sort of a general pool of goldenness, no legs. And then in the center of its chest was a very familiar, rotating, continually protean cube that looked very much like the cube that you had in your possession, which, by the way, had been completely silent since you had appeared here.
Yes.
And you attempted to talk to this being that called itself Primus, and you bothered it.
Yeah, he wasn't too impressed with us.
Yeah, so he decided to kill Bastion.
The Warforged monk.
Yes. In his words, increase the median intelligence of the party.
So, finally, a cost for dumping intelligence in 5e.
It was randomly rolled between Bastion and Bahar.
So we basically explained everything that we knew, focused mostly on the consequences that would come from whatever they were plotting.
Primus seemed very aloof and full of hubris, to the point where Primus said, "Oh yeah, this junction, that's my idea. We're going to do that, but it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. I appreciate your concern, but you should go."
Yeah, we're like, it's not going to work the way you think.
And Primus essentially shooed you away after you convinced Primus to resuscitate Bastion.
Yeah, because, I mean, that was kind of a low blow.
Right, which he did promptly and with no ill effect.
Right.
So then, of course, you being you, the party decide to take matters into their own hands.
Yeah, we meddled a bit.
Yeah, just a bit. You knew that the epicenter of the Day of Mourning, the place from which it emanated, was beneath the tower. So you went back into the sewers where you had initially appeared, knocked down a few walls with big fists.
As you do.
And discovered a chamber and a door. And the door had a depression in it that would perfectly fit half of a 1 foot cube, which you happened to have on you.
Yes.
And you inserted cube into the depression and the door opened.
And I believe this is where we walked into a chamber filled with shards.
Well, first there was a labyrinth. You made your way through the labyrinth and then, yes, there was a very, very large chamber. Sort of I think the way I described it to you was think of that scene in The Matrix, where all those pods with the people. Okay, but instead of pods, they are kyber shards.
And Sivir shards.
And from your quick analysis, inside them are bound fiends and celestials.
Yes, we were looking at a giant battery, effectively.
Yes. You didn't know what the battery was going to be used for, but you were pretty sure it was not going to end well.
Right. So we ended up fighting a handful of devils and demons through the labyrinth, and then inside this chamber found an open portal to Shavarath, the plane of war.
Yes, where in Eberron, the angels, the demons, and the devils continually fight all the time.
So we closed that.
Whew.
You know, problem solved there.
All done. And then you found a crystal with a bound celestial inside that you decided, well, we should maybe take this.
Yeah, because, you know, why do all this work if you're not going to have a little taste yourself?
It also did seem important because it seemed like the devils and demons were placing it in a particular location for some unknown reason.
Right.
So, all done. Good job. And we'll find out the consequences of that next week.
Yeah, next week we learn about the number one law of PCs. Unintended consequences.
Oh, totally intended on my end.
All right, so let's talk about our main topic for the week. One-shots.
Some of you whose normal campaigns have been interrupted may be trying to plan a one-shot right now.
Yeah, you're home for the holidays. You're hanging out with your old friends from high school. Somebody goes, hey, man, remember when we used to play D&D? That was awesome. We should get together this weekend and play a game.
You know, it would have been great 6 months ago if you had been listening to a podcast about how to put together a one-shot, and then that had told you how to do it, and then you had done that, so you had one in your back pocket for this very moment. And then you think, man, that would have been great. Maybe I should listen to a podcast that tells me how to do it now, so 6 months from now, I will have, or 6 days from now, I will have it in my back pocket.
6 hours.
Yeah. Just do it while, run it while you listen to this podcast.
Or perhaps you're interested in joining the Total Party Thrill one-shot that will be occurring over the holidays as well with some of our listeners, and you have reached out to us at TPTcast to sign up for our game.
Disclaimer, games Shane runs as one-shots usually turn out to be like 4 shots.
Okay, it'll be fine.
You try to do one shot, but...
It's only your group, our group at home, that caused that problem.
Never stop a one-shot.
All right, so... Holiday specific example aside, why run a one shot?
Well, while it can be a lot of extra work to create these characters in this story that is just going to end quickly, it's really nice to have one in your back pocket for emergencies. It's certainly far better than canceling a game.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it also, it gives you a chance to experiment. Players can play different character styles than they normally would, and they're not committed for long term, and you can try out new systems, or you can try different character personalities. I like to play paladins, but in a one shot I'm not going to play a paladin because I can do that anytime.
Right. I will say one thing that really helps the longevity of a very long term campaign is scratching that itch for your players when they're thinking, oh man, I'm getting a little, not necessarily tired of the character I'm playing now, but like I want to try something else, I want to try something new.
Right.
This gives you the opportunity to do that without just throwing out an entire campaign.
And it's also great for GMs because anyone who's GM'd long-term knows that you eventually burn out. You just, coming up with a new story every week just wears on you eventually.
Mm-hmm. And it's a really good way for new people who haven't GM'd before or who don't have a lot of experience doing it to get their feet wet. I actually started off GMing one-shots.
Yeah, me too, because I usually killed off my party.
Mine were so complicated and convoluted that they always ended up turning into 3 shots.
Fair enough. That happens to me a lot in our home group. But another thing that I like with one-shots as a GM is you can try kind of more experimental ideas.
Mm.
You don't need to adhere to the normal arc of an adventure if you're only going to do it once. You know, everyone's only committed for a few hours, so you can take some liberties with the normal expectations.
Yeah, you can experiment with almost anything. Honestly, you can try a slightly different mechanic that you may want to try out in your real game.
So, what are the requirements of a one-shot?
Well, it's got to be short.
Oh, yeah. One shot.
Mm-hmm. You've got 4, if you're lucky, 6 hours to get this entire thing done. And that's including pee breaks and drinking and joking, because you know usually these are happening in at times when the normal rules don't necessarily apply, and it's the holidays or it's vacation or whatever.
Yeah, the angry GM actually has a good sort of phrase to describe the requirements for a one shot: 4 hours and an ending. It's all you need.
Yeah, I could get behind that.
I mean, as long as you deliver a satisfying ending, you can kind of skip over whatever parts you've got written down. You can sort of narrate and just keep the players hitting the important scenes.
Well, I'd say along those same lines, I like to, when I'm creating one shot, really pare things down to like one genre. So for 4 hours, we're going to be doing an investigation.
Sure.
Or a dungeon crawl.
Yep.
Or this will be about running away from zombies. That's it.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
And along with that, you want a really obvious win condition. It's fine if it's really obvious. Either the party escapes the situation, they solve the puzzle, they kill the lich.
They steal the jewels.
Yep. And that's it, right? You don't need to go into all of the aftermath and the effect on the country.
Right.
Yeah. And similarly to investigation campaigns that we were talking about last week, it really helps to have some kind of countdown. The players don't necessarily need to know about it, but at certain points in the story, if the players haven't gotten around to advancing the plot, for whatever reason, poor roles, or just because they're not really focusing, the plot advances itself in some manner.
Yeah, I really like your example. So if your investigation is going slowly and you haven't found the clues that implicate the vizier, who's clearly guilty because his title is vizier, mm-hmm. after an hour, he sends an assassin because he's figured out that they're investigating and he tries to kill them.
Right. This isn't the time to be subtle. The assassin has a note from the vizier that says, go kill them.
Yeah. And that's fine. Sometimes you just need to improvise to agitate the players in the direction you need.
Mm-hmm. And this is a little bit like what we were talking about last week. The villains don't necessarily have perfect information. They don't need to act perfectly. Sometimes they make stupid mistakes.
Right. So let's talk about the storyline. What kind of structure do you want to use?
Again, simple. Sometimes I like to put together a flowchart with no more than two or three moving parts. You know, people or parties who are invested in the outcome of this story, maximum two or three.
Yeah, so a bit of an aside. I just received the Kickstarter book for Shadow of the Demon Lord. And in the GM section, it actually talks about the structure of the story, right? And there's sort of a scale between linear and he calls it well, which is that you start out with a large number of options of where to go and you gradually pare down your options until you eventually get to the end. Hmm. And then there's sort of the hybrid, which is a web where you've got decision points at certain times. You want to be linear. Everyone is expecting linear. That's sort of how a one-shot works. You give them a bit of a challenge. They overcome it. That gives them the clue to get to the next challenge.
Right. There's no time for red herrings here.
Exactly.
So you're going to want a list of those triggered events for your countdown. Right? What is it that needs to happen and when does it need to happen? This is honestly more prep than I usually do for a normal session. But of course, you're not doing one-shots week in and week out.
Right.
And railroading is totally fine. Often it's preferred, but you know, you still want to maintain that illusion of choice.
Also, consider focusing on the narrative much more than the simulation. So don't worry about tracking every little bit of movement. Don't worry about tracking all of the travel from place to place. Kind of keep everybody bottled up and focus on, okay, so we're in this place. All right, now we're going to go check out the mayor's office. Now we're going to go back to the hotel. And if it's more than a throwaway description of what it takes to get there, you're wasting time.
Yeah, those kinds of interstitial vignettes are far less compelling in a one shot. Just hand wave them.
And then it's a good idea to know where you're headed, right? Have an idea for the final scene. Because like we quoted from the Angry GM, 4 hours in an ending. You got to know the ending.
Yeah, and like we said, in this way, railroading is fine. It's fine if you know where this story is going to end. If the final confrontation is going to be on a windswept cliff with an army on one side and the party on the other, your triggered events are going to get them there. And it's fine if they don't really have a whole lot of choice in it. It's still going to be a compelling story.
Right, right.
Specifically because it, you know, it's one shot. It's not an entire campaign of railroading.
Exactly. And speaking of windswept cliff with an army at your back, lean towards thrilling heroics or just brutal evil. Like, go for the extremes because... Mm-hmm. Anytime you're dealing with shades of gray and sort of moral ambiguity, it takes time to develop that and set that up and have impact. And you just don't have the time to do it.
Right. You need to have spent time with these characters to understand what it is that is driving that particular action. But all good or all evil, or, you know, for the most part, makes sense intuitively.
Right. And on that note, if you're doing a one-shot, it is a great idea to come with pre-gen characters, or at least have your characters made in advance by the players, because you don't want to waste time of your limited 4 hour slot to create characters.
Right.
Unless you can do it in about 10 minutes.
Right. With something like feng shui, but honestly, pretty much anything else, have them made ahead of time.
Yeah. And it's fine to give them a choice of characters, mm-hmm. but go ahead and give them a motivation. Here's the reason they're here. Here's a quick summary of who they are, and then let the player take it over.
In the same way, if you are using a new system, which of course is one of the more fun things about being able to do a one-shot, it should really be a pretty simple system, or everyone needs to commit to familiarizing themselves with all the rules beforehand. It's usually often better to run a system that you already know and enjoy, but you don't play often, but you know, of course you need to get it out of the way at some point.
Yeah, it's really tough if the players don't know the rules, And the GM is also learning as well.
Right, exactly. So, you know, we have a bunch of systems that we talk about that we play occasionally that we like, but we just wouldn't want to play every single week.
Yeah. And we also have systems that we have on the back burner for basically one-shots where the person who runs that system knows it well and mm-hmm. the rest of us fumble along.
Right. And it's just, since it's so story-focused, we just kind of roll with it.
Yeah.
And actually, that's one potential option for these kinds of occasional one-shots is, you know, we have alternate characters in this alternate system, and we play one game every 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it was with my high school friends, right? When we mm-hmm. got back together after college, it was just like, all right, well, we still got these sheets of paper filled out. Do you want to give it an old roll?
Mm-hmm. And it's what we do now with Deadlands, Eclipse Phase, and Shadowrun.
Right, right. Also, there are systems that are designed for one-shots.
Mm-hmm.
Fiasco comes to mind.
Right.
Paranoia as well. These are games that aren't meant to have a second session. So give those a look because they're a blast.
And since they're designed that way, they're very simple to pick up and just run with.
Yeah. Also, in terms of your prepping, have all your props ready to go. If you're using map and minis, have the maps and minis ready. Don't waste time at the table digging through a box to find the right ones. Or, oh God, drawing maps.
Yeah, if you know you're going to draw them, right? Because you, for the most part, are going to know the locations that they're going to be at anyway. Don't let them go somewhere that you haven't already pre-planned. That's going to take too long.
Right, right.
In the same way, if there's any complicated information, it's really great to spend the time to make handouts. If they find a letter, print out the letter so that instead of repeating yourself and reading it over and over again, you can just hand it to them. And then one person is reading it and figuring it out while everyone else is deciding, okay, where are we actually going to go?
Yeah. And if they miss the clue, if they have the letter in their hands, but they don't pick up on the moment in the story where they need to take a look at it, just point at it and they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And then if you're going to run a twist, pick the time that it's going to happen, probably somewhere around 2.5 hours of your 4-hour game. And that's when the twist happens. And sometimes it falls flat. It doesn't matter. You're pushing towards an ending.
Yeah. As for actual gameplay, in the same way, right, keep your eye on the clock. Know when your triggered events that push the story forward need to happen. Not necessarily within the game world, but in the real world. You've got 4 hours? Okay. The vizier needs to be exposed by 1 hour in.
Exactly. Yep. And keep in mind combat. Because
mm-hmm.
combat can be a total time suck. So either have enemies that are happy to run away when they're defeated, or be ready to just hand wave. You guys, you mop them up. It's fine. The rest of the goblins you have no trouble with.
Right. With combat specifically, I think a lot of one-shots end with a big combat.
Yeah, it gives you that epic outcome. You don't know if the players are going to win or lose.
Right, but it takes a long time. So you really want to give yourself at least like an hour and a half before your session actually needs to end, and already you're beginning the final combat.
Yeah, I mean, depending on the system, right?
Sure, but they always take longer than you think they're going to take.
Oh, yeah, especially if you're talking large scale in terms of the number of opponents. If it's a one-on-many kind of combat, it's probably going to be a little shorter.
Right. Back at the beginning of the session, keep your intro short and geared around what characters can see on their own. All these backstories and hidden motivations that you usually do at the beginning of a very long campaign are less important, or they can be telegraphed during the play. But it doesn't really matter, like, if your parents were murdered, unless that's a central point of the one-shot.
No, the one-shot is a perfect time for the one-note character. Mm-hmm. It's okay to just be the drunk dwarf. Like, that's a perfectly acceptable one-shot character because it's got something that identifies it at the table. It will be fun at some moment when he does something silly, and it's a perfectly playable backstory.
And 5 years from now, that's what people are going to remember about that particular game.
Right, right. And, you know, you have the freedom as a player. There's a reason your dwarf drinks, right? If you want to explore that...
Because he's a dwarf?
Well, maybe he drinks a bit too excess because he has something to forget. And if that comes out at the table, great. And if it doesn't, great. It's a one-shot. Keep it moving.
In the same way, as a GM, present clear-cut options. Do they turn left or right? Do they kill the bandits, or do they go rescue the mayor now? Your players should understand, okay, here are the things that we are able to do so that they can quickly make a decision and then quickly move toward it.
Yeah, It's that idea that the blank page is the most intimidating. You've got to put something on it to inspire them. Offer up, hey, are you guys going to go chase down the bandits, or are you going to go talk to the mayor?
Mm-hmm.
They might say a third option, and you'll figure it out from there. But if you don't give them something, they might sit there dumbfounded, like, all right, well, what do we do? There's so many things we could do. I don't know what to do. Let's talk about it for 20 minutes. No, we don't have time for that. Pick one.
But fortunately, you're keeping an eye on the clock, and if they do try to talk for 20 minutes, well, 5 minutes in, your triggered event happens.
The bandits attack.
Yep. They got notes in their pockets.
Or the mayor wanders through and says, I was expecting you. Where have you been?
Right. Let's go. Along with the narrative, keep combat flowing too. So when you're actually playing, many of you probably already do this in your normal games, but in a one-shot, they're even more important. Delegate tasks like keeping track of initiative.
Yeah, and as a player, it's not like your normal weekly game. Pay attention to what's going on in combat, maybe a little bit extra, and have your idea or your actions ready to go when it's your turn. You don't need to be hyper-tactical. It's just a one-shot.
Right, and it's also a good reason to develop a one-note character.
Oh, yeah. I've got one thing. I knock people to the ground, and then I drop my spiked elbow on them.
Right. There's one alternative option for one-shots, and that's the bottle show. And that means using the characters in the normal campaign, but removing them somehow or putting them into a very short, truncated story that's completely encapsulated.
Yeah, this is a TV trope where the cast of characters is outside of their normal set and thus tied into one area in a sort of a one-shot episode.
Right. Now, of course, this doesn't let you play different builds or different kinds of characters or a different system, but it does really let you take a break from a long overarching story, and it lets all of the players sort of focus on a different kind of genre for a little bit.
Yeah, we've actually talked about one of these on the show, right?
Yeah, first episode, we talked about the Pit of Five Sorrows, which turned into like a three-shot, but initially it was intended as just a one-shot heist.
Right.
Which was very different from the normal sort of investigation, combat, puzzle solving of the normal campaign.
Right. Another great option is to run a one-shot from an alternative perspective. So rather than playing as the PCs, they're playing as a group of NPCs sort of tangentially related to the main plot. Perhaps they're the town guard after the PCs have blown through town. They're left picking up the pieces, and you're showing the players the repercussions of their actions.
Shouldn't have stolen all of their weapons to sell at the next town over.
Yeah.
It's going to be really tough to fight off the goblins.
It's going
to
be really hard now. Yeah. You created that problem.
Things like this, and then having your players play through those consequences, are an interesting way of having one shots have repercussions outside of just the one game, like you did.
I literally just did that to you.
Yes, yeah. You did. We played a one shot of Dark Heresy, and we were like, hey, it's one shot, whatever.
Yeah, steal all their gear, make ourselves combat monsters. We don't need to be able to investigate anything or do anything right because there's no consequences. There's no tomorrow.
Hey, we rolled randomly. None of us were able to be investigators. But then, of course, when we actually started a real Rogue Trader game.
Yeah, so I made the Rogue Trader vessel that you had been delivered on to begin the one shot of Dark Heresy happened to be the one that you were now the Rogue Trader players on.
And now we were picking up the pieces of the chaos that our old characters caused.
Yeah, I believe your first task is to eliminate each of them.
It's too bad they're combat monsters.
Right. It sure sucks that you looted all of the heirloom weapons and gave them to them. Stole them, frankly, from the leadership in order to make yourselves better at fighting.
Hey, at least we know they have heirloom weapons that we'll get if we kill them.
Maybe.
Unless the crit tables have them explode.
Right, right.
All right, so let's run through a few potential story hooks for different kinds of one-shots for people who may want to put one together right now.
Yeah, I mean, you should get started immediately because this weekend is coming fast. So we could do a basic fetch quest. So let's say the princess has been captured by a dragon. You've got to fight your way into his lair and then return her to safety.
These kinds of things usually end up kind of boring in a normal campaign because there's so many other different kinds of things that could happen, but they're just tropey enough that everyone understands what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, exactly. I know exactly where I gotta go. I gotta figure out where his lair is. I gotta fight my way in. I gotta negotiate or kill him. and I got to get out.
That's right. And if an hour in, we made it to the inside of the tower and it's not a princess, but it's a dude in a mushroom hat. Well, I think there's another
tower. Yep. Yeah. there's also the dungeon called Challenge.
This is one of my favorites that I used to play a lot of in fourth edition. It was a genre called Fourth Core. It was basically an impossibly hard dungeon, and the players were tasked with building as effective a character as they possibly could to show up at this dungeon and then see if they could beat it.
Yeah, it's sort of the dungeon is literally your enemy and you are adversarial against the DM.
Right. I will say that it differs slightly from old modules like Tomb of Horrors in that they're not supposed to be just totally random and crazy. They're supposed to be beatable, but very difficult.
Yeah. This obviously is going to be the gamiest of the possible one-shots.
Mm-hmm.
How about a murder mystery? Let's say the classic inheritance scenario where the PCs have been hired to guard the inheritance of a rich noble. The heirs have all been summoned to his country estate for doling it out and the reading of the will. The first night, one of the heirs is murdered. You've got to figure out who stands to profit the most from this and who's capable of murdering a cousin.
I love that this kind of scenario also turns into a bit of a puzzle, because then you start mapping the legalese of who inherits one thing once one person's dead. And then on subsequent nights, more people get murdered.
Right, right.
It becomes 10 little Indians.
Yeah, exactly. This one's going to require a lot more prep, probably.
Yeah. Also, decide who it was at the beginning. Don't change it in the middle.
Oh, yeah. They'll probably notice. They'll guess right and then talk themselves out of it anyway. Just keep a poker face. It'll be fine.
There's, of course, the natural disaster survival game. For example, you know, the zombie outbreak is unleashed upon the capital. And the PCs, who are bodyguards of the Burgermeister, must navigate the city that has been overrun by the undead hordes and escort her safely to the safety of the militia. This is nice because it gives a very obvious win condition. And you can have multiple NPCs who need to be rescued, and then how well did you do? Well, how many did you save?
Yeah, and this is a good way if you'd like to tie in backstory. You can trade out the person that they're trying to protect. Perhaps they're just neighbors, or the PCs have some other connection and they're each trying to save a family member or something.
Or maybe it's just a random NPC, but then later when you return to your normal campaign, it turns out to be the...
Shows up. Yeah. Right.
Or it was their relative of a future NPC.
Sure, sure. There's also the gladiator.
One of my favorites.
The PCs have each been kidnapped and forced into the fighting pits. Will they work together and fight for their freedom, or will they fall to the cruel barbarism of the gladiatorial games?
If you've got a bunch of players who are usually like in fighting anyway, then you may just want to put them all on the same side and say you have to fight as a team. Otherwise, it's just going to fall apart. It's not going to get through in 4 hours.
Yeah, so one of my favorite games to play during the holidays, non-role-playing games, is Diplomacy. Because we've got the same group of friends.
That's nobody's favorite game to play.
Oh, it's everybody's favorite game to play. Who plays with me?
Everybody likes to play it, but no one has a good time.
That's true. But this has a little bit element of that, right? Where it's possible for a couple of the PCs to win and the others to lose, and everyone wants to be on the same team. If you set up the characters correctly, that will be hard to accomplish. Do you hear that, Ishan?
I think that is the sound of me backstabbing another player so that I can be the head gladiator.
It also sounds like it's time to move on to the character creation forge.
All right, that too.
But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We love hearing from them.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne, that's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
And if you can't fit your message into 140 characters, you can also email us at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And finally, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So today in the Forge, we promised you Santa Claus. And, well, that's what we've got. Shane, what's Santa's build?
This seems ridiculous. First of all, this build is playable at lower levels, but Santa Claus is definitely at least 17th.
Yeah, absolutely, because Santa Claus has wish.
He has wish.
He grants wishes. That's what he does.
Right. So with that in mind, let's talk about what Santa Claus is known for, all the abilities that we have to give him.
Well... He sees you when you're sleeping, and he knows when you're awake. So obviously he has to be able to scry.
And he knows if you've been bad or good, which he probably has Zone of Truth or maybe the criminal spy background.
Or both.
He has magical reindeer, which he probably got through Fine Steed.
Which means we know we got some paladin in there.
He travels the whole world in one night.
Which you obviously have to do with teleportation because there's nothing else that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He has a giant bag of toys.
That's just a bag of holding.
Which he fills throughout the year.
Toys. How does he make all those toys?
He uses Wish.
Yes, indeed. So remember, you can ask Santa for toys that cost up to 25,000 gold pieces.
Right, right. Well, I mean, he does have to make all the toys, and he gets one wish per day for 364 days. So 364 wishes, the total value of his toys is limited. So if you're asking for that 25,000 gold piece toy,
no, he can make 364 toys that are worth 25,000 gold pieces. But he doesn't, on the other days, he can just make, on some of those days, he probably just makes 25,000 gold pieces and then uses them to pay people to make toys.
Right, right, right. Yeah, he's got to fund the whole elf workshop.
I mean, the union.
Right, so. Yeah. And then he also is known for spreading holiday cheer. So probably bardic inspiration.
Well, fortunately, Bard Paladin is a great combination.
Yeah, so we went with Devotion Paladin 6.
Immunity to Charm.
Right, because he's not being tricked by those naughty kids.
That's right.
They're not going to charm him and get toys. They're getting coal.
Also extra attack.
Right. Bard 14, and that's College of Lore, obviously. He knows an awful lot.
So much. He's got expertise, which maybe it's animal handling.
Yeah, probably. And like, I don't know.
Insight?
There's no more profession skill, but I feel like he would have profession toy maker.
Yeah.
He definitely has proficiency in toy making tools, right? He's got that from his background somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. He's got artisan tools.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. When building Santa Claus, we didn't need to make him combat effective, which was nice because we could just sort of pick and choose the abilities that would make him flavorful, but he really is combat effective.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah. The paladin bard combination has a nice bit of utility from the bard and then huge burst damage from the paladin. So it would be fun to play Santa Claus. You've just got to keep in mind, you've got to use a one-handed sword because you're always carrying your bag of holding over one shoulder.
Right. And
he's probably wearing robes of the Archmagi, right?
Oh, right. That's a good point.
I mean, I know technically they've got to be white, gray, or black, but I mean, I feel like he might inject a little color into the...
Yeah.
He's got Wish, after all.
I mean, they come one color. You can press digitate the color of your clothing.
Good point. All right. Well, would you play Santa Claus, Ishan?
I totally would play Santa Claus.
It does seem fun for a holiday one-shot, right?
Yeah. Also, ridiculously overpowered for a holiday one-shot.
Yeah. If you're playing a level 20... Oh, that is one thing to note. You have to hit Bard with your level 20.
Right.
Because you need to get your last magical secrets at the same time you get ninth level spells. It's very important to get Wish.
But obviously Santa Claus is level 20.
Yeah. He's definitely level 20. All right. So it's time to beg for reviews. If you'd like to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you're willing to help us out and do that, we will read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. And if you like us or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
And we do have 2 5-star reviews today, one from iTunes and one from Stitcher. So from iTunes, a great gaming podcast, 5 stars by The Singing Lumberjack. I took a chance on this podcast and have grown to really enjoy listening to it. I'm not a 5e D&D player, and honestly, from the discussions I've listened to now, it's not quite my cup of tea. I've played it, and would again, but not a game I feel like I want to invest in. So even that, I really enjoy listening. The banter between both hosts is great. They break the podcast up into sections, so no one topic gets boring. I enjoy the character builds and the different mindsets that go into it, though it's clear now that level 1 rogue is too powerful given that it's used in nearly every character build. Keep up the good work. I will point out, Santa was not a rogue.
Although now I'm thinking, we can't spare the level
for a non-caster, I know.
But Bard gets expertise, so we're okay.
Yeah.
That's fine.
I actually think it's not that Rogue One is overpowered, because if you compare Rogue One to anything else, it's not particularly great. It's that we like the expertise, because usually our builds have some iconic skill that we're trying to chase after. And the best way to represent sort of paragon tier skills is with expertise.
Yeah, and in general, as players, we kind of have a skill bias.
Yeah, that's true.
We just like having lots of skills. It's one of the reasons that we say Barbarian 6 for Tiger. Oh, yeah. It's not particularly powerful, but two skills.
Yeah, we like having the skills.
Yeah. And in 5e, dipping is really effective for the most part. One or two levels of lots of different classes are really good.
Yeah, and especially if you're going to stay deep in one class and only dip in one or maybe two, it's right. generally a pretty good.
Especially if you're trying to fit a particular type or archetype of character where you need an iconic ability from somewhere else. A lot of them are available at very low levels.
Yeah.
We've also got a review from Stitcher. This one's from Melvin Smith. Deep Rule Analytics. 5 stars. I'm a fan. Just finished the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide episode and walked away, well, continued sitting at my desk, impressed with the deep level of analysis these guys put into their work of reviewing the product. Even if you were to disagree with something, you can tell that they do a great job considering an effect one rule inclusion might have in comparison with another, i.e. the addition of flight for tieflings. I plan to listen to more. Well, we're glad you will.
Yeah, and thank you. So, what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We've got our year-end Best of Mailbag Extravaganza, so we're really glad that you sent along all those letters.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
Continuing the theme, we'll have our favorite builds.
So just lots of Rogue One.
Obviously. Yeah, okay. Just the hordes of Rogue One.
All right. Well, that's it for episode 21 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.